Good morning, everyone. The National Broadcasting Company brings you the latest news direct from overseas. During the next quarter hour, we are to hear from three members of NBC's European staff, some of the American radio reporters stationed in every important world capital. We take you first to London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. Official word was received in London today that RAF Catalinas, flying 300 miles off Singapore, sighted Japanese naval units. The vessels included cruisers, and they seem to have been heading toward Thailand. We've had no information of any military action to mark the official British declaration of war against Finland, Romania, and Hungary today. Police have begun rounding up nationals of these countries who are living in Britain. The total number in Britain is estimated at about 6,000. Among them is the Baroness Anastasia Mannerheim, daughter of the Finnish commander-in-chief. There are signs today that the development of the Battle of Libya is slowly making British observers feel the need of a British Army Air Force. Since the battle began, the RAF has held clear air superiority over the fighting area. But it's generally admitted here that the fullest and most efficient use of that mastery hasn't been made in cooperation with the Army. Whether the need for a separate Army air arm will result in the creation of such a force is something else again. To defend this island of Britain and to carry out long-range bombing of Germany, the compact Royal Air Force proved its efficiency and won great glory in doing so. The RAF has never developed its army cooperation to anything like the degree of the Luftwaffe. But if RAF leaders fight creation of an army air arm as they fought creation of the fleet air arm, it'll be difficult to contradict men who have built up a fighting force of the strength and morale of the RAF. However, to some observers here, the Libyan fighting has proved that ideally Britain should have three air forces. A fleet air arm for work at sea in cooperation with the fleet, an army air arm to act as an integral offensive and protective weapon of the army, and a Royal Air Force to protect Britain, carry out long-range bombing, and give fighter protection for strategic areas. The authoritative aircraft magazine, The Aeroplane, admits that Britain still has much to learn in using air superiority in cooperation with land forces, and calls the Libyan situation a novel state of affairs of which we have had no previous experience in this war. The Sunday Times, in reviewing the Libyan campaign today, points out what the German air arm achieved in the Norwegian, Dutch, French, Greek, and Cretan campaigns. And the Sunday Times says, no general of ours was ever left the chance to maneuver as General Rommel has. To say this is not to doubt the RAF's good work in attacking enemy transport, but the proof of the pudding is in the eating. They have not rendered their enemy's army incapable of winning battles, whereas the German air arm did. Major Oliver Stewart, one of the best-known British writers on air matters, says in the Sunday Observer that although the RAF bomber force is shaping into the most formidable weapon in any armory on Earth, alone it may not be able to knock out an objective the size of Germany. He points out that the Luftwaffe couldn't knock out Britain, and emphasizes that the army and air force working together are stronger than the sum of their individual efforts. It's believed here that the Germans are trying to build up their air force in Libya by flying fighters and bombers from Crete and Greece to Africa. The experts believe that Germany hasn't any vast sources of air power on which to draw, so that new planes for Africa will have to be withdrawn from Russia, occupied France, or Germany. Germany is thought to be using her entire air strength at the moment. Whether there's any relationship between events in Libya and the Russian advance on the southern front isn't known by London observers. The general feeling about Libya today is that the British Army is learning its lessons the hard way. In tank repair and the tactical use of armored formations, the British have been following the Germans. Rommel dispersed his tanks, reconcentrated them quickly, and split the British supply line through Tobruk. This slowed up the British power of recovery because they had to fall back on their long overland supply route. But control of the air and control of the sea, plus better supply lines, give the British a feeling of assurance for the future. However, there's been a good deal of criticism in London of the Pollyanna publicity given to the campaign by the Cairo military spokesman. If you'd been listening on a high-power radio receiver in Britain this morning, you might have picked up some odd bits of news. For instance, the Belgian radio didn't make any mention today of the marriage of King Leopold. The Italians officially stated that even detachments of fascist youth regiments had fought with stubborn bravery in Africa. Japan said that Fritz Weidemann, former German consul in San Francisco, has arrived in Shanghai. And Mussolini, according to the German radio, has seen the former Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. The subject of their talk is said to have been the Arab countries. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And now a few brief bulletins from our newsroom in New York. Rome. Italian planes torpedoed two British cruisers while the warships were shelling Axis positions west of Tobruk. Rome says one ship probably was sunk. And from Rome again, RAF bombers smashed again at the strategic Italian port of Naples during the night for the second time in a row. Rome says explosive and incendiary bombs damaged buildings and a church. Two persons were killed and one wounded in the raid. From Moscow this morning comes word that German forces are being held or driven back in every sector. That's the big point of all Russian dispatches this morning. On the front around Moscow, Soviet sources acknowledge the danger has not been eliminated, that the Germans are still waging a terrific battle to reach the Kremlin. But in three sectors around Moscow, to the west, southwest, and northwest, the Germans are said to be suffering great losses. Well, now we turn overseas again for a report from one of Europe's few remaining neutral nations, as we switch to Bern, Switzerland.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lanius in Bern, Switzerland. This morning at 1 minute after midnight, three new armed conflicts were added to the European war scoreboard. That was the time that Great Britain officially announced the state of war with Finland, Romania, and Hungary. In reality, the newcomers in the European arena are old hands at the game. England has been in since the start, Hungary since the Germans walked into Greece and Yugoslavia last spring, and Romania and Finland jumped in when the German invasion of Russia started on June 22nd. The warring countries have actually already been fighting each other. British planes and tanks, complete with trained British military instructors, have been used against the Hungarian and Romanian troops in the Ukraine and against Finland in the north. In the Balkan runover, British soldiers in Yugoslavia put up a losing battle against the Germans and the Hungarians. In the diplomatic field, every move made by any of the three German allies has been bitterly contested by Great Britain. Finland's case is unique. It was only 2 years ago that England was allied with Finland in its one-sided contest with the Russians, sending arms and soldiers to the Northern Front. Now that Finland is lined up with the Germans and apparently can't wiggle out of the bargain, the British find themselves in a peculiar position. They must declare war on the allies of their enemy, Germany. The actual declaration changes nothing. But as observers here point out, it makes everything legal. There's not much doubt that the Finns would like to quit fighting. They've gotten back the territory they lost in the first Russian-Finnish war, and feel that the drain on their manpower is too much for a little country. But the Germans, although they say officially that they regret the necessity, aren't going to allow the Finns to back out, especially when there's a possibility that Finland's retirement might open up an avenue of supply to the Russians. Well, there it is, a political and military jumble if there ever was one. Meanwhile, the battles in the east aren't letting up in violence. It's estimated that the German army, totaling 2.5 million men, are hammering away at the gates of Moscow. Latest reports here this morning indicate the actions on all sides of the Soviet capital are becoming more furious in spite of the snow and bad weather. But even with heavy reinforcements of men and material, the Germans are making painfully slow progress against the numerically inferior forces of the defenders. In fact, at a number of points where the Germans have advanced, particularly in the Volokolamsk area, they've been forced back again by Russian counterattacks. The Germans are paying a high price for their gains. But stories reaching here are that the high command has ordered Moscow to be taken regardless of the cost. In the south, the Germans are still on the retreat. The Russians claim that their 56th Army has reached the peninsula of Taganrog and have cut off the retreat of a considerable German force. On their side, the Germans assert the Russian attack has eased up in the last few hours and that their troops are still in possession of the city of Taganrog. Little fresh news is available here from North Africa. The situation is just about as mixed up as ever. All of the British report successful new actions west of Bardi and southwest of Saloum. The British say they now have about 3,000 German prisoners and more than 4,500 Italians in camp. Now, that's a brief summary of the news here today. This is Charles Ronius in Bern, Switzerland. I now return you to NBC in New York.
And here is a bulletin just received in our NBC newsroom in New York. Hong Kong. A general mobilization has been ordered in the British Crown Colony of Hong Kong on the South China coast. The official proclamation makes British forces there subject to the Army Act for 3 months from today. Just as though they were on active service, another proclamation calls the Volunteer Corps to active duty until further orders. And now to the capital of unoccupied France. We hear Paul Archinard speaking from Vichy.
Hello, NBC. This is Paul Archinard in D.C. Today, December 7th, finds the city of Paris with just 3 days left to discover and arrest the latest attackers of German soldiers stationed there. When an unknown person heaved a bomb into a restaurant of the 18th District, killing 2 German soldiers and a woman, and wounding 2 other Germans and other persons, the entire 18th District, which includes a part of the famous Montmartre night section, was ordered battened down at 5:30 every afternoon. After 6 in the evening, German patrols were liable to shoot on sight anyone found in the street. The ruling had barely gone into effect when right next door to the 18th District, in the 10th, a German medical corps officer was shot and wounded. The special curfew law was immediately clamped down on the 10th District and lifted for the 18th. A December 10 deadline was set for the arrest of everyone concerning with the crime. Then over across the Seine in the 6th District, which takes in a part of the Latin Quarter, a German major was shot by a cyclist who got away. Now this rapid succession of assaults has sorely tried the nerves of the Paris police, and the prefect, Admiral Barre, appealed to the population for aid in identifying and capturing the culprits, while the Paris papers rave and froth at what they call ignominious crimes against the nation, the people are apparently not very tranquil over the possible outcome. Although no one likes occupation, the great majority objects to murders. Besides, everyone remembers only too vividly the shootings of hostages in Nantes and Bordeaux, which followed assaults on Germans in those cities. Also, many people gaze askance at the Paris Red Belt, which has been particularly active with communist propaganda these past few weeks. Being the best organized of anti-German groups, the communists are accused of misdeeds more frequently than the others, and the Red Belt, which was already quite a headache for peaceful middle-class bourgeois before the war, when internal dissensions often threatened, is more than ever attracting public attention and police investigations. The Red Belt of Paris is that wide stretch of industrial suburbs which surrounds the capital. Up to now, no assaults have taken place in the Red Belt, where few isolated Germans ever go anyway. However, Paris is bearing the brunt of the trouble, and it is in Paris that things may happen if by Wednesday night no arrests have been made. But domestic troubles and foreign events are somewhat overshadowed by news and speculation on events in the Pacific. The exchange of notes between Washington and Tokyo is anxiously followed with perhaps even more interest than that given to the fighting in the East or England's declaration of war on Finland, Hungary, and Romania, the utility of which commentators here fail to grasp. But the strained relations between Washington and Tokyo have touched a tender spot in the French foreign policy. The government in Vichy signed an agreement with Japan in July 1941 concerning Indochina. Consequently, it has felt called upon to state its position as regards the Far East colony, which is particularly vivid in public recollection. Official sources stress with much insistence that the position of France in Indochina is one of neutrality, and that the government accords with Japan are strictly defensive and must not be associated with military measures against any third power. On the other hand, and though official circles refuse to admit that an attack on Indochina by a third power is at all probable in the immediate future, they do not deny that defensive agreements with Japan call for the defense of Indochina in case it is attacked by a third power, but in that event only. Authorized sources in Vichy state that the attitude of the French government in face of a conflict in the Pacific can be expressed in 2 words: peace and neutrality.
And that's the news. These have been reports by John McVane in London, Charles Lanius in Bern, Switzerland, and Paul Archinard in Vichy, France. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Till next Sunday at the same time, may we wish you the best of luck, every happiness, and a most pleasant week to come.
It has been the pleasure of the National Broadcasting Company to bring you Sammy Kaye's Sunday Serenade, featuring his world-famed swing and sway music. The poem read by Sammy Kaye was When We're Apart by Wilson Darren. Today's broadcast has come to you from our studios in Radio City, New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
the NBC newsroom in New York. President said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked the Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air. I repeat that. President Roosevelt says that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air. This bulletin came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York.
Walkage talking from the newsroom in the White House in Washington again. We have just received a copy of the message which the president delivered to the Emperor of Japan Saturday afternoon. And in that message, the president addresses himself to His Majesty, as he says at this moment, in the fervent hope that Your Majesty may, as I am doing, give thought to this definite emergency, to ways of dispelling the dark clouds, and that I am confident that both of us, for the sake of the peoples not only of our own great countries, but for the sake of humanity and neighboring territories, have a sacred duty to restore traditional amity and prevent further death and destruction of the world. And he points out the specific issue that the people of the Philippines, the hundreds of islands in the East Indies, of Malaya, and of Thailand, are asking themselves whether these forces of Japan are preparing or intending to make attack in one or more of these directions. Well, the Japanese government answered that with the bombs over Honolulu and Manila, answered it with a torpedo that sent an American ship to the bottom, answered it with the threatening blows at a cargo ship within our own territorial waters off San Francisco. But the message is, I can give you a part of it. We have much time here. He begins by saying that almost a century ago, the President of the United States addressed the Emperor of Japan a message extending an offer of friendship of the peoples of the United States to the peoples of Japan. That offer was accepted, and in the long period of unbroken peace and friendship that followed, our respective nations, through the virtues of their peoples and the wisdom of their rulers, have prospered and substantially helped humanity. That's the way the president opens this message. Then he goes on to say that only in situations of extraordinary importance to our two countries need I address Your Majesty messages on matters of state. I feel that I should now so address you because of the deep and far-reaching emergency which appears to be in the formation. Developments are occurring in the Pacific area which threaten to deprive each of our nations of all humanity and all humanity of the beneficial influence of the long peace between our two countries. Those developments contain tragic possibilities. The people of the United States, believing in peace and in the right of nations to live and let live, have eagerly watched the conversations between our two governments during these past months. We have hoped for a termination of the present conflict between Japan and China. We have hoped that a peace of the Pacific could be consummated in such a way that nationalities of many diverse peoples could exist side by side without fear of invasion, that unbelievable burdens of armaments could be lifted for them all, and that all peoples would resume commerce without discrimination against or in favor of any nation. I am certain that it will be clear to Your Majesty, as it is to me, that in seeking these great objectives, both Japan and the United States should agree to eliminate any form of military threat. This second essential of attainment of the high objectives. More than a year ago, Your Majesty's government concluded an agreement with the Vichy government by which 5,000 or 6,000 Japanese troops were permitted to enter into northern French Indochina for the protection of Japanese troops which were operating against China and further north. And this spring and summer, the Vichy government permitted further Japanese military forces to enter into southern French Indochina for the common defense of French Indochina. I think I am correct in saying that no attack has been made upon Indochina, nor that any has been contemplated. During the past few weeks, it has become clear to the world that Japanese military, naval, and air forces have been sent to southern Indochina in such large numbers as to create a reasonable doubt on the part of other nations that this continuing concentration in Indochina is not defensive in character. And then he comes to the point that I mentioned before, stating that because these continuing concentrations in China have reached such proportions, and because they extend now to the southeast and southwest, the peoples of the Philippines and the Indies have begun to fear an attack. That was the last appeal, the last argument. And then he goes on to say, I'm sure that Your Majesty will understand that the fear of all these peoples is a legitimate fear, inasmuch as it involves their peace and their national existence. I am sure that Your Majesty will understand why the people of the United States, in such large numbers, look askance at the establishment of military, naval, and air bases, manned and equipped so greatly as to constitute armed forces capable of measures of defense. The rest of the message I read to you, you can see how it was the last the last appeal, the answer to the argument that that this country had offered continually, stating that those troops could not be going there for mere defensive purposes. Now we know the truth. They were not. That's all for the moment from Washington, and thanks very much.
While Balkage was talking in Washington, a wire came in, a bulletin, that the Supreme Command of the nation's defense forces are now in conference at the White House. Secretary of War Stimson, Secretary of Navy Knox, and General George C. Marshall, Army Chief of Staff, were with President Roosevelt. Admiral Harold R. Stark, the Chief of Naval Operations, remained at his desk in the Navy Department. A bulletin from Honolulu. Parachute troops were sighted off Harbor Point today. And now for Navy men in the New York area. Here's a notice that all Navy personnel in 3rd Naval District are requested to report to their ship or station as soon as possible. And now, for the benefit of our listeners who may have missed our first direct contact report from Hawaii a few minutes ago, here is the text of this broadcast over NBC. We have witnessed this morning the attack of Pearl Harbor and a severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by Army planes, undoubtedly Japanese. The city of Honolulu has also been attacked and considerable damage done. This battle has been going on for nearly 3 hours. One of the bombers dropped within 50 feet of Tanti Tower. It's no joke, it's a real war. The public of Honolulu has been advised to keep in their homes and away from the Army and Navy. There has been severe fighting going on in the air and on the sea. Then there was an interruption followed by this. We have no statement as to how much damage has been done, but it has been a very severe attack. The Army and Navy, it appears, now has the air and sea under control. Keep tuned to this station for further details. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Hawaii came as a complete surprise to most people in Britain. The first intimation that the general public had of the move was made about an hour and a half ago on the regular BBC news program. Now it's the topic of all conversation and a great deal of speculation. One well-informed quarter said to me tonight, an attack on Burma or the Dutch East Indies wouldn't have surprised us at all, but the straight, bald-headed way the Japanese acted against Hawaii was completely unexpected. In view of Mr. Churchill's recent statement that Britain would follow America within the hour if she became embroiled with Japan, the general feeling here tonight is that the British government will lose no time in making it stand plain. No official statement has yet been issued, and official quarters are waiting eagerly for further information. Some well-informed quarters in London tonight explained that an official British declaration of war would probably have to wait for a clarification of the official American attitude, and noted that officially, the United States can't declare war until Congress meets. But nobody here supposes there will be any hitch or delay in British action. The man in the street presumes that measures have already been coordinated between the British and American Navy chiefs for the defense of the Pacific. And although the Admiralty is keeping mum, most people believe that the British Navy has already decided what part it will play in this new action in the Pacific. We return you now to New York.
We take you now to San Francisco.
From San Francisco, we present NBC's expert on the Far East, Upton Close.
Hello, fellow Americans. The most fantastic thing that has yet happened in this fantastic world is the bombing of Honolulu and the bombing of Manila and the sinking of several ships off this coast. We don't know yet what's behind this. There's more behind it than meets the eye. So far, the reports that have been coming in have been entirely based on military sources and military understanding and military computations. I think I have just received the most interesting and perhaps the most important sidelight on what has happened. I remembered very well the Manchurian incident of 1931, when the Japanese army overnight sprang upon the Chinese army and seized Manchuria. The next day, I was in touch with the Foreign Office in Tokyo. I discovered that it was a complete surprise to the Tokyo Foreign Office, and that that government in Tokyo, if it had been properly pressured by America and England, would have repudiated that attack and declared it a mutiny. I have just been in touch with the San Francisco Japanese Consulate General. The consul, Mr. Yoshio Muto, was not able to talk, but his representative and secretary, Mr. K. Inagaki, spoke to me from the home of Mr. Muto. He said that the attack is a complete surprise to the foreign consul general here in San Francisco, that the San Francisco Japanese Consulate General knew about it was hearing it over our radio, and he implied that it is likewise a complete surprise to the Foreign Office in Tokyo and the Japanese government in Tokyo. Now, that may prove to be true. It is very possible that there is a double cross in this business. I suppose that if the attack on Honolulu had been made in such force as to destroy the American naval base there, we might believe that the Japanese government was behind it as a matter of policy. But you notice that the news gives us every assurance that it is far from destroyed, and that the only thing left there now as a result of the first attack are a few parachute troops wandering around on the sand somewhere on the north end of Wahoo Island. They will soon be pulled in the bag, and we'll find out who sent them. It is possible, my friends, that this is a coup engineered by German influences and with the aid of German vessels in the Pacific. Again, it is possible that this is a coup engineered by a small portion of the Japanese Navy that has gone fanatic and decided to precipitate war. And still again, it is possible that this is a coup engineered by the group in Japan that wants war kicked out of office. And that when the thing is brought home to the Tokyo government now, it might be possible for the Tokyo government to repudiate the action, call upon the nation to repair the injury to America by agreeing to American terms and precipitating a complete revolution in the government in Tokyo. All of these things are possible. You will have to wait and see what happens. Now, I would be glad to go on and talk as long as they wish me to take the time on various phases of this situation. It seems to me that if the coup is precipitated by those fanatics who have wanted America at war with Japan and vice versa, it might have been done as an answer to the answer of Secretary Cordell Hull to the envoys Caruso and Nomura. You notice we are told that Mr. Hull burst out in true Tennessee language and told the Japanese that their reply was crowded with infamous falsehoods and distortions. I have been in many a Japanese brawl, I am sorry to say, and I have seen many an argument with Japanese that would have ended just an argument, suddenly burst into violence because something was said by one of the so-called white people in the brawl that suddenly lashed across the Japanese face. Now, it is possible that the Japanese completely lost face and descended to the status of being willing to engage in a violent brawl as a result of this answer, although it might be that this answer and Secretary Hull's message came at the same time. But it sounds like one of those Japanese arguments that suddenly descends into violence. We cannot be sure yet that the Tokyo government is behind it. As to the president's address to the Mikado Saturday noon, which we just learned about through Mr. Balkage in Washington, certainly it was a very sweet and a very humble message. And it reminded Japan of the way in which America stood by Japan 100 years ago when Japan was coming out of medievalism and becoming a modern power. And if America had not mothered Japan at that time, Japan would have been destroyed by the empire-building nations of Europe who were attacking Japan at that time. Today, we are mothering China in the course of her changeover from medievalism to modernism. This message, if it reaches the Japanese people, will have a very interesting and valuable influence in Japan. Thank you for now.
From San Francisco, we have presented NBC's expert on the Far East, Upton Close. The National Broadcasting Company takes you now to Honolulu.
One moment, please, while we attempt further contact with Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu.
The island of Oahu in the Pacific, one of the most thickly populated islands of the Hawaiian group, was attacked by Japanese planes this morning, starting at about 8 o'clock. No one would believe when reports emanated from the two radio stations here that the islands had been attacked. But when bombs began falling in various parts of the city and in different Army and Navy posts and bases, people knew Japan was endeavoring to eradicate America's outpost in the Pacific. Now, here's a report that I've gathered from different reporters of the Honolulu Advertiser who've been out endeavoring to get information concerning the Japanese air attack on the island of Oahu in the Hawaiian Islands. The first information in Honolulu that planes of Japan were attacking the islands was about 8 o'clock this morning, Hawaiian time. The first group of Japanese airplanes attacked Ford Island at Pearl Harbor, the Navy's mighty fortress in the islands. Roy Batusik, a local attorney, was up in his private plane flying over Coco Head when he said one or two Japanese planes gave him a salute of machine gun bullets as they approached the city. The plane was slightly damaged, and Mr. Batusik made a landing. After machine gunning Ford Island, the first Japanese planes moved to Hickam Field. Observers said considerable damage was done to planes and to Hickam Field. There is great activity there now in clearing the field of debris. At Pearl Harbor, where is based the Pacific Fleet, three ships were attacked. The Oklahoma was set afire. All lines of communication seemed to be down between the various Army posts and Navy airdromes and Army airfields. There has been no statement made by the Navy. The Army has issued orders for all people, the civilian population, to remain off the streets. The first raiders carried torpedoes and did their damage to shipping in Pearl Harbor and off Honolulu. Everyone here in the islands were taken by surprise by the attack, and even yet it's difficult for some people to believe that our air raid on these beautiful islands has actually happened and that lives have been lost. Several planes have been shot down, and anti-aircraft gunnery is very heavy. It is thought that the planes came from the south in the direction of the island of Kauai. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, Hickam Field, and Peter Field, several squadrons of Japanese planes, the planes came in from the south over Diamond Head, dropping bombs and incendiary bombs over the city. One bomb dropped in front of the governor's mansion at Washington Place and killed one man. Another dropped by the Honolulu Advertiser, nearly hitting several people and almost reaching its mark. At Pacific Heights and Dowsett Highlands, beautiful residential districts, there was heavy bombing. One woman was killed in Dowsett Highlands. The governor has proclaimed a state of emergency. Traffic is almost at a standstill in part of the city. However, the traffic to and from Waikiki seems to be normal. When Japanese planes appeared over Waikiki, there were many people out in the streets and watched the bombing there. One man at Waikiki was badly injured when a bomb dropped in the heart of that beach resort. The Japanese planes seem to have come over the city and the environs with no intimation whatsoever that these were Japanese planes. And it was very difficult for people here to believe that these were Japanese planes. Here's a report that just came from Hickam Field. There were 350 men killed in a direct bomb hit on the barracks at Hickam Field. Then at Bellows Field, on the other side of the island, on the windward side of the islands, the field was bombed very heavily.